Okay, it's a great pleasure to welcome James Montague to the Football Scholars Forum. Freshly off an airplane from, where? Australia, James?
Australia, yeah, just off Australia.
But on the interwebs, there is no time.
And there is no time, there's no space, there's just voices.
There's just voices and intellectual peladas. So what we are going to do today is have a chance to discuss your new book, 31-0, On the Road with Football's Outsiders, a World Cup Odyssey, which we've all read. And we tend to start with the author sharing a few thoughts, anecdotes, anything you'd like to kind of serve as a springboard for our discussion. So I pass the ball over to you, James, and to everyone else, please, you can raise your virtual hand by using the chat function, the IM function on Skype as well, okay? And here in East Lansing, we have Alejandro Gonzalez and Liz Timms and I. So over to you, James.
Wow, I mean, where do I start? I mean, I guess the genesis of the book came a few years, actually during the last World Cup qualification campaign. And I remember I was standing in the Cairo International Stadium, and a lot of you here have got kind of a lot of interest in Middle Eastern football. So they'll remember the Algeria-Egyptian game in 2009, which had all sorts of political connotations, colonial connotations. And the fallout from that match wasn't just felt in Egypt, it was felt in Algeria, it was felt in France, it was felt in London, where I watched the second replay of that game, where there were Algerian and Egyptian fans who were kind of separated by British riot police. There was an incident in Sudan where there was the replay. There was it was so political that even Gaddafi had got involved as a kind of as a go-between between the presidents of Egypt and Algeria, which is crazy. And I just thought, you know, I've been following these World Cup qualification campaigns, and for me, it told the story of the world politically and socially over that period. Not perfectly, of course, there's some stories that you can't cover, but it's a pretty good primer. If you wrote the story of a four-year period or a three-year period of qualification for a World Cup, then you would find kind of a pretty decent stab of a story of the world during that period. Which sounds kind of grandiose, but it wasn't. I mean, you know, so that's where I kind of started out. I thought, well, when the World Cup qualification campaign for 2014 began, I knew I had to be at the first game, and I knew I had to tell the story from then. As it turned out, the first game I actually missed because they changed the they'd actually changed the it was CONCACAF and it was Belize versus Montserrat, and they brought the game forward, and I was actually planning to be at Palestine versus Tajikistan, which is an interesting story in itself because Palestine is recognized by FIFA, has its own national football team, and it's one of the few kind of symbols of nationhood that the Palestinians have. So that was the first game I went to, and from there, yeah, I think it, you know, it was a crazy journey through all six continents, but you know, I think it was as good a reflection, I think, of the world during that period that I think you could find in a single area, if you know what I mean, whether it's poetry or music or any other kind of cultural thread that you want to use. I think football is unique because it's found everywhere and because it's so loved everywhere that you can really use it as this mirror and a reflection of what's going on in society around it. And yeah, I mean, it kind of started in the West Bank, and yeah, 3 years later, kind of a little bit ruined, single and kind of broke. It ended in Zagreb. Well, actually, San Marino, but I mean, yeah, Zagreb was the last kind of competitive game that I saw.
Great. Our first question is going to come from Roger Kittleson, and should note that Roger was also our guest in the previous FSF session when we discussed his country of football. Roger, and then Daniel.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. And yeah, this is my time to turn the tables and to give back some of what I got from you all. And first of all, really, congratulations, James. It's a terrific book. It really does have amazing coverage with a great analytical touch. You know, you cover so many important places and events and really at the same time it's a wonderful read. One of the main tensions that that's running through the book, and I just wanted to ask you this very general thing to start off with, is between the national, the construction of nations, partly through football, but then also some of these transnational processes. One of the things you do so well is tell these stories of how different new nations, young nations, or just relatively less powerful nations put together their teams out of different diasporas. So there's the national and the transnational, and that must have been something that you really kind of struggled with, but also obviously found some real fun in.
Yeah, I mean, for me, again, talking of this as a reflection of the world, what was interesting, I mean, we're no strangers to globalization or the kind of mass movements of people, but when you saw, I think, through the book, and something that I wanted to pick up, was that every team that I went to, there was the diaspora, and the tension between the diaspora and the tension between the local players and the local people that have been left behind. And I think that's reflected across all of these societies. I mean, I always go back to Haiti, for instance, when I went to Haiti and did a story about the national team. And you could see, the guys that were brought in, these players who were brought in from America and from France had grown up and they'd been brought up in a kind of Haitian diaspora environment. But it was very difficult to integrate them with Haitians who'd grown up in Haiti, and the envy and the spitefulness that existed in those communities. But, as much for me, national football teams are one of the most potent and powerful forms of symbols of national identity. And you could see, especially, I mean, when you see, and I think one of the things that I hope came across in the book is how politicians, not just normal people, like people on the street who, really attach themselves to the national team, but also how politicians are attracted to these teams like moths to a flame. To them, they understand that national football teams tap into something that is very similar to the type of power that they're trying to wield in their countries. And, for me, that was something that I'd always seen. But every time I turned up in a country, you would see the president, you would see the prime minister, you would see the most powerful men and women in that country attach themselves, looking for reflected glory in some respects. And in other cases, when it came to the Palestinians, for instance, it really is, when you see who's involved, a guy called Jibril Rajoub, who is one of the highest ranking members of Fatah, who was Yasser Arafat's former West Bank security advisor, he's being talked about as a possible replacement to Abu Mazen. You can see that politicians and powerful people are attracted to football because I think it triggers the same aspects and same areas of the brain that, when you talk about nationalism and identity and nationhood, football does that as well, and it's a very powerful thing. And it was very local in that respect, because obviously you're trying to build a kind of a national identity, based on a border. So I suppose that is very national. But then equally, because of the mass, migration of people, because of war and poverty and for whatever reasons over the past 50 years, where it's really accelerated, it's become a global issue where, equally you have people who are set in national borders, but you have these children who have been spread far and wide by whatever civil wars or economic hardships that's forced them away. So it's intensely local and intensely national, but it also has an irreversible international aspect to it as well.
Thank you.
Next question from Daniel.
Yeah, I wanted to ask something similar on diaspora and politics of naturalization. In the introduction, you give the example of Montserrat, and they're doing their open try for the national team in London. So is this like a pattern you discovered, like the smaller the country, the more they're dependent on players from abroad? And how is the acceptance of the national teams consisting of diaspora players? How's the acceptance at home? What do you think in general about the FIFA regulations on naturalizations? I think one has to live 2 or 3 years in the country. Can you give
It's a great question. I mean, basically, I'll start with the FIFA naturalization. I think they've got it actually. I mean, very few people give FIFA credit for anything, but I think they've got the naturalization laws correct because they had to change them a few years ago. And in my first book, When Friday Comes, about football in the Middle East, you know, I broached the subject of Qatar. And this is very much before they got, you know, the 2022 rights to host the 2022 World Cup finals. And they were very good at playing the game of naturalization, which they do within the IOC and within many other sports. When you see lots of Qatari athletes are actually from East Africa. And what really has changed is they brought in a rule that you had to stay, I think it's 5 years after the age of 18 in a certain country, which makes forced naturalizations very very difficult, or not forced naturalizations, but let's say slightly immoral naturalizations. Like the example that was always given about Qatar was they tried to, there's a Brazilian striker called Ailton who they tried to sign. Who they, you know, we wanted to give him $1 million to help them qualify for the 2006 World Cup, which is obviously subverting the very basics and building blocks of the of international football, which is based in some way on a common thread of ethnicity or nationality or identity, which obviously you can have in the diaspora. And in some cases, when you look at Australia and you look at Croatian and Serbian nationality and identity there, is actually kind of the hatreds in some respects are a lot stronger there than you'd find back in, say, Sarajevo, where you have Bosnian Croats and Bosnian Serbs who have to kind of live together in a city. And so go back to your previous question about the diaspora. Yes, if the smaller countries, all of them, and this isn't just Montserrat. I mean, as a British, as an Englishman, you know, we grew up with what was disparagingly called the granny rule. Ireland, I mean, we remember Ireland, you know, qualifying for various World Cups. A tiny nation, you know, with, if you think about actually the football heritage in its league, you know, actually not much, but they exported a lot of players. A lot of players had grandparents who were Irish. So they, you know, in the 80s, they very cleverly exploited the loophole that said if you had a grandparent, you know, then you could then play for that country. So you had, you know, players that in England, we would disparage them. Many of these players who were English didn't have any kind of Irish connection whatsoever, but would end up playing for Ireland at a World Cup finals. So we're kind of very used to that. But so smaller nations have been using this as a step up for a long while. And when I mentioned Haiti, and I mentioned especially other places like Antigua and Barbuda, who are another team that very small island, but many Antiguans and Barbudans have ended up emigrating to England or the UK, for instance. There's a strong British connection. You could feel there was definitely a tension because, of course, there is. There's a shared, you know, people look the same. They've eaten the same foods because they've grown up in a culture, whether it's grandparents in London or, you know, in Antigua and Barbuda, you know, that's what your life is all the time. You know, there's a common cultural thread, but that's it. That's kind of where the connection ends. And there was a very real resentment through the players that some of them would be much more talented. But as Edson Tavares, the Brazilian coach of the Haiti national team, told me, you know, Haiti has all the talent in the world, but if you feed kids one meal a day, you're not going to be strong enough to play international football. So in many cases, the players that were coming and playing in, you know, the national teams that had grown up abroad were not as talented as the players that were growing up locally, but they had better fitness, better conditioning. You know, they could run for 90 minutes. And, you know, I think probably the best example of what happens, you know, most of these teams overcame that. You know, I didn't see any teams really pulled apart. I mean, it sounds funny saying this, but I mean, the Palestinian national team had these issues as well between players in Gaza and players in the West Bank, because they were completely separated, and they felt that West Bank players got greater leeway than them, even though all the talented players or many of the talented players came from Gaza. I didn't see a team pulled apart by it, but you could definitely see in defeat the fingers of blame were being pointed out. But I think the last chapter in the book, or the postscript, looks at a team that couldn't do that, San Marino, who probably the worst team in the world and probably will always be the worst team in the world. And that's because it's almost impossible to become a San Marinese citizen. Absolutely impossible. So they've tried to bring in, you know, players who have married a San Marinese woman or someone who's... But, you know, they have a very absolutist view on blood and identity and what it is to be San Marinese, which they do have in many Gulf countries as well, but they usually allow, you know, exceptions if it means glory on the football pitch or in the Olympics. But in San Marino, they're having none of it. So, and because they don't have any of it, you know, and I think I'll never forget the quote from the head, the chairman of the San Marino Football Association says, you know, I think I'm paraphrasing here, but yeah, you know, we're bad, but we're pure, you know. And I think that shows also a little something wider about societies that have an influence of immigrants and immigration. You know, it's a healthy thing, and it's a good thing for cultural plurality and also for kind of economic growth. And actually, if you do put up the borders and you do decide, actually, we're going to try and stick to this very kind of almost outdated notion of complete genetic and, you know, I don't know, kind of individuality, then actually it kind of leads to a kind of decay, I guess.
Right. I mean, I think there is nothing against naturalization if it reflects the general citizenship laws in one country. And what's happening in the Gulf is it's hardly possible to become a Qatari, for example, unless you are good in football.
Well, that's it. That's the thing. And actually, the citizenship rules in the Gulf, I think, are absolutely disgraceful. I mean, I lived there for many years, and you see how they're abused. And you see equally how... you know, when you look at the American system, for instance, you know, I mean, part of the deal, I mean, a lot of immigrants were treated like shit when the building of America, but you got a stake in the future of the country, you know, give us, you're tired, you're hungry, you're poor. And, you know, that's not happening in the Gulf, and that's not happening with Qatar with the World Cup. Although it has to be said, and I'm sure we'll come up to Qatar again, you know, the every migrant worker I spoke to in Qatar, I spoke to many over the years, you know, thank the Lord that they're in Qatar and not in Abu Dhabi or Dubai or the UAE, where it's far worse, conditions are far worse, and there's less spotlight. And so, you know, the 2022 World Cup has actually, I think, been a great positive, because it's really forcing reform, I think, and genuine reform. And I can't think of any single thing that would otherwise force Qatar to really take a look at the kafala system in that way. I mean, certainly the UAE isn't, you know.
Thank you.
Chris, if you don't mind, Martha is going to intervene at this point, because she has a question related to this very discussion. Is that okay, Chris?
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you. Okay, Martha in Berkeley, California.
Yeah, so it's sort of related to the diaspora question, and I've seen a lot on this side too, that you have a lot of entrepreneurs who are able to be sort of big fish in small ponds, because they, you know, they have some skills, whether they're actually good skills in either coaching, training, or organizing football, or they can talk a good game, or they bring money with them. And so in these small places, and that same tension between the players, how, and the administrative level, you know, how much of this is playing into it as well, and wondering then also, maybe we're not always getting the best soccer skills, whether administrative, training, coaching, but people who are, you know, really good at flying into the little pond and taking over.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a couple of issues here with that. I mean, there's there's one of them is coaches in particular, you know, bringing in coaches from outside, you know, kind of dropping them into kind of completely alien environment, and then especially in African football with mediocre white European coaches. But within the diaspora, you know, yeah, there are a lot of big fish in those ponds, you know, and you know, the problem is that a lot of these places do exhibit, you know, a high level of corruption. So, you know, if you have money, then you have patronage, or if you have patronage, you have money. So, you know, you would see figures within certain federations who were, you know, related to presidents, related the last names you'd recognize. And obviously that isn't good, but that isn't good for football. Because as soon as you bring out, that isn't good for sport, it isn't good for society, because straight away, you know, you undermine the idea of meritocracy and you have very mediocre people in charge. But it wasn't the, you know, these teams and these players, because it was such a, because ultimately, you know, the greatest meritocracy is organized sport, because you cannot hide. You cannot hide that. You can have money, you can have bribery, you can be the president's son, you know, whatever. None of that matters once you go on a football pitch or any kind of competitive sport. You'll be found out and you'll be embarrassed. So in a way, in a lot of these countries, especially in the developing world, you know, you saw as good a players as you could possibly see. Because if you look at China as an example, for instance, where there were allegations that, you know, players were only getting, because obviously huge corruption there, that players were only getting picked if they could pay the huge bribes to go on to those teams. And they plummeted from qualifying from their first World Cup finals, you know, God, Christ, almost, you know, 15 years ago now, you know, to being a basket case where football was almost destroyed because of the kind of horrific corruption. It just shows that you have to have, you know, that sport is this meritocratic thing. So actually, although there were many of these figures surrounding it, you know, the kind of talent willed out in a way, you know, and that was actually quite heartening to see.
Chris.
So I want to actually get away, totally change the topic here. Talk a bit about process. I'm wondering how you made your decisions on where to go. You have, you know, hundreds of games to choose from. What sort of led your journey through the book?
I thought I knew the first game until it got changed, but by then it was too late. It was either one side of the world or the other. And I knew, you know, I mean, I'm sure we all do it. When there's a football tournament, and the qualification groups are drawn. I mean, I certainly do this, but you look through and you think, oh, okay, Romania, Hungary. Well, you know, I know that there's a quite severe, long-standing political, possibly future military issue between these two countries. That's going to be interesting. Any Balkan countries, any conflict, you know, any other stories that come through. So there were, I would look through and think, oh, okay, so I can see that. I can see the Libyan national team, for instance, you know, who I knew very well from the last book. And we could have had this post-Gaddafi kind of hangover at the time, which is now kind of breaking out into full-blown civil war, looking at where they're traveling, and they're going to be, they would be an exiled team. So I looked at those first. I knew the first game, and I knew how to choose the first game. It was really important. I think Palestine, Afghanistan, you know, it wrote itself, you know, that being the first ever World Cup game to be hosted in the West Bank, on you know, occupied Palestinian territories. I think that was absolutely, you know, the right decision to make. And then after that, it was a little bit playing it by ear. You know, I would pick up threads of stories, so I would know, okay, what would be the first Asian. So I knew that I wanted to do, obviously, at least one story from each confederation. And I knew that I had to do American Samoa. If I was calling this book 31-0, which it was always called, I had to go to Samoa. And that trip almost broke me. You know, I had to travel from, I was actually in Rwanda. I had to travel from Rwanda to Brussels to London, London to Abu Dhabi, Abu Dhabi to Sydney, and then Sydney to Wellington, and then Wellington to Samoa. And you know, that was a low point. But you know, so really all I knew was the first game. And I kind of knew that I wanted to do San Marino as my postscript, because I was interested in seeing, you know, a lot of the stories that I do about underdogs, you know, it's about the hope before the reality sets in. And I wanted to speak to a team after they'd been put through the washing machine, you know, what it was like at the other end. You know, what does that do to your psychology, your psyche? What does it do to you as a person? How does that affect your normal life? If you go out and you're beaten 15-0 in front of 90,000 people, that must affect you in some way. So I knew that there was a kind of bookended thing, but I took a really organic approach. Every game week, I was like, okay, what's going on here? You know, there were some stories I couldn't get to because of financial constraints. I wish I'd gone to Venezuela. You know, because they were the only team in South America who hadn't qualified for World Cup finals. And so it was obviously very interesting what was happening there with Chavez. And he died during a qualification process as well. So, yeah, I kind of played it by ear, really. And I was very lucky that many of the stories that I ended up choosing kind of came back to life later on. And one of the prime examples would be the Eritrea team. Like, I knew, looking at the Eritrean team playing in the 2014 World Cup qualifiers, I knew that was their first game in years because of the story of the mass defections of the national team. And as it turned out, the players that I interviewed and saw, who I did a New York Times piece on this as well, who did go back to Eritrea, most of those players then ended up defecting, and I ended up following them to a Dutch town earlier this year where they've all ended up getting political asylum. So it was kind of seat your pants stuff, but with a very basic skeleton of knowing that Serbia, Croatia, for instance, would be a standout match of the qualification process, you know, Egypt, having spent time there during the revolution, seeing how football was very important in the revolution, and seeing how they had an American coach at a time when there was rising anti-Americanism in that country, you know, I knew that would be a key story as well. So it was just keeping my life, what's the word, supple enough, I guess, that I could make this. I couldn't have a job, you know, I was just freelancing, which at times was very difficult, you know, and I think I've mentioned this in several interviews before. I mean, my relationship didn't survive it. So it was a very, you know, it was, you know, you had to make sacrifices for it. It's not something you could have done with a full-time job.
That's really interesting. Thank you. Alex Galarza next.
Great. Chris, excellent questions. You asked exactly the question I was going to ask. And then James touched on my other question, which was how he dealt with CONMEBOL, which you just said. You would have loved to have gone to Venezuela as the only team that hadn't qualified for a World Cup. So maybe if you want to elaborate on CONMEBOL, Uruguay comes up against Jordan in the
yeah,
as well. But I was just wondering how you thought through CONMEBOL in this underdog narrative that even though Venezuela has not qualified in the Copa America and in the qualifications, they've, you know, in the last two decades made much better. They've made a much better go at it in the qualifications.
Well,
and
Alex, it's a great question, because this was the bane. This was the thing that kept me up at night thinking, what do I do about South America? Because, you know, there are very natural underdogs in every other confederation, you know. But the South American confederation is so strong that even, I mean, Venezuela would beat pretty much everybody that I wrote about from every other confederation that was an underdog. I mean, they would have, you know, it's that strong. So covering them was a really difficult thing to try. And so I was always looking for a way in, and Venezuela was the way in. But then very expensive to get to. So, you know, so I had an opportunity to go there, and eventually it didn't come out. And Uruguay, again, you know, in terms of underdogs, if we look at size of population and achievement based on that, which I think is one of the many ways I looked at what defined an underdog, you know, it was... You know, I knew that there would be a South American angle in the playoff, because obviously I knew there would be this Asian playoff, so I knew there would be that as well. But in the end, what I decided to do was to do about an underdog in South America. And because it was a book about the Brazilian World Cup, I thought, okay, the Confederations Cup is coming up. I'll go there. Tahiti qualified. I'll go and do the story of Tahiti in Brazil, and we'll get some kind of flavor of a Brazilian, a South American, but obviously that's, they're two very different things, but a Brazilian World Cup. And then what happened when I landed was it turned out not to be a story about, or a chapter about, Tahiti or underdogs. It was a story about, mass street protests of the likes of which, you know, in numbers I hadn't seen, not even in Egypt, where I'd seen some, very, you know, especially in Port Said, I'd seen some very, you know, horrific, you know, I mean, people were shot dead there. And you know, people were shot dead in Brazil as well. But in terms of numbers, you know, 200, 300,000 people on the streets of Rio, you know, and so it was always something that kind of kept me up at night, that there is this kind of huge part of this book missing because there isn't enough South America in it. But as it turned out, you know, Tahiti was a very small part of that chapter. And actually what it was about was the preparations for Brazil, and the underdogs became not the team, but the protesters themselves and the fight they were fighting against, you know, entrenched business and political interests. So I think it just about saved it, but I would love to have done Venezuela. And like you said, that is, it's the one thing that keeps me up at night.
Thank you. It's great.
All right, I'll ask the next question. I'm enjoying the conversation a great deal. In fact, I have a comment first and then a question. Really a tour de force of travel football writing, James. I can see why Grant Wall calls you the Indiana Jones of soccer writing.
that was a tweet that he dropped, and we've just kind of run with it. So I think he probably hates it that it gets used everywhere. But I love it. It's brilliant. I'm going to have that printed on T-shirts.
I particularly enjoyed the chapter 4 on American Samoa, Cook Islands, Samoa, Tonga. I thought that was one of those chapters where, you know, everything came together quite beautifully. You know, of course, Samoa provides also the title to the book.
Yeah.
But I really felt like we were on the outskirts of world football, you know, and the personal stories that you wove in there fit with the larger themes nicely. You had Blatter Stadium, where the match is held. You had, of course, the story of Thomas Rongen, you know, who left MLS and the American national team, U.S. national team set up to go and coach this very marginal side. You had the goalkeeper who was present in the 31-0. Defeat, who's trying to redeem himself, and of course the first transgender player, Jaya Selua, who plays in a World Cup qualifier. It was a great chapter. I also like the Switzerland, Albania, Kosovo one for the reasons that we've been talking about now, because that's where you really saw national identity being so thick, so fluid and situational and contextual.
Yeah.
And of course, in Europe, you know, immigration is probably the political issue with the economic recession and sort of the changing face of Europe and individual versus country and Islam and so on. And then I never thought Transylvania was going to be such a contentious issue, but maybe that just says how little I know about Eastern European history.
Well, you know what? It was something that I didn't even know about. I mean, I should know about it. But I mean, the point was, I met a Romanian girl, fell in love with her, and I moved to Romania, and she kind of opened my eyes to the internal political issues that were in Romania, and one of them being, you know, the Hungarian population and how the increasing nationalism. When, you know, people are getting very scared now. What's happening in Hungary? with the Fidesz party and Viktor Orban. And, you know, he's, you know, it's almost like a kind of forward operating base for Putin, but within the European Union. And him and Jobbik, which is basically the extreme far right political party, who are now, I believe, the second single biggest political party in Hungary, they're really ratcheting up this tension amongst the million and a half Hungarian speakers in Romania. So when she opened my eyes to it, it was just, you know, it was like, wow. It was like, I didn't know about this. I didn't know this was going on. And this has the potential to have a Balkan style conclusion, because you have very powerful vested interests who have an interest in the instability, and you have a government in Bucharest that's kind of sleepwalking towards that. And seeing that play out, you know, through football, for me was fascinating, because it isn't just about a Romanian team playing a Hungarian team. It's, it's also about, again, talking about football as a pride, as a kind of sense of identity. If you think about the Mike Magyars of the 1950s, of the 54 Puskas, these people still have murals on walls in Budapest. And I lived in Budapest for a little while during. I actually wrote most of the book whilst living in Budapest. And, you know, the train that took the fans to Bucharest, you know, had all the faces of the team painted on them. It's an intense, in a country that's becoming increasingly nationalistic and dangerously nationalistic, those symbols of pride are even more important. And also their failure on a national team hurts even greater, and their feeling of injustice hurts even greater. So seeing that, a lot of these issues I knew kind of, I have a framework of, okay, I could see that that's a political issue that's important. I could see, obviously, Serbia, Croatia, you know, I've read widely about the Yugoslav civil war. A lot, you know, I would come from, because I started off as a political journalist, so I would, you know, see the stories almost from these matches. Whereas Romania, Hungary, you know, it kind of blindsided me, and I was there seeing it, and I was like, wow, you know, this is serious. And so that was the most, I think, the most illuminating chapter when it comes to the politics of the book. But in terms of the moment that was the most important for me, it was American Samoa. Being there for their first ever victory, it was just blind. I mean, I knew I had to be there, but to actually get there and see it with a transgender player at centre-back who was man of the match, to have Nikki Salapu, the goalkeeper, I mean, almost clipped the clean sheet, but, you know, and to be there and this cathartic moment when they won, I recorded it for a half an hour documentary on the BBC, and I listen back to it occasionally, and it's still goosebumps and tears in my eyes. But I would recommend everybody to go and watch. There's a documentary made about it, Next Goal Wins, which is probably the best soccer documentary, possibly the best sports documentary ever made. It's beautiful. It looks fantastic. But they've caught it. They've caught a moment. And I think that is the best documentaries aren't just documentaries that tell a story. They also have an insane amount of luck to catch a very unique moment in time. And so watch Next Goal Wins, because it is fabulous. And it really does. It doesn't just tell the story. I mean, I came to it on the island. They followed them from a previous tournament where they really got hammered. You know, I think it was the South Pacific Games. And from there, and speaking to them in American Samoa, because I was only in Samoa, which is a sovereign nation, whereas obviously American Samoa is unincorporated territory of the United States. So they actually went there and spoke to them. But there is a very interesting caveat to this story, is that whilst I was writing the book, somebody tweeted me from American Samoa and told me that the equivalent of the American football, the Gridiron World Cup, was taking place, and American Samoa had beaten Australia something like 96-0 or something. so they got their revenge in the end, but obviously in a different type of football.
That's great. my question has to do with this whole idea of outsider and underdog.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it obviously weaves through the narrative, and it's very nicely explained in the introduction, but it seems to me that those terms mean very, and concepts mean very different things in very different places and contexts. I mean, American Samoa, you know, the phoenix rising from the ashes, almost qualifying for the next stage, but not quite. I mean, that's clear. But Bosnia, with fielding players like Dzeko, to me doesn't seem to fit as nicely into the paradigm, into this framework. So more about this concept of outsider and underdog. Expand a little bit. Thank you.
For me, it was about, you know, I had to think. I mean, for me, it's kind of instinctive what's an underdog and what's an outsider. And it was always overcoming some form of barrier that would lay low a lesser man or a lesser team or a lesser woman. You know, it was a barrier to be overcome that would be almost impossible for anyone else to be able to achieve. So there were, you know, so I looked at, for instance, population, I think, is an important thing. You know, tiny country. So Iceland, although a very wealthy country, you would say, you know, one of the highest GDPs in the world, but a population of 350,000 to make a team out of the population of a small town in England, that makes you, we'll talk about the difference between outsider and underdog. I'm trying to figure that out myself still, but let's say as an underdog, when you've got a team from you know that is made from a population of a small town in Britain, when people complain in England about you know the lack of English players coming through, and you see someone like you know Iceland who just beat the Netherlands on top of their group in the European 2016 qualifiers, by the way, so I think they do that is the spirit of the underdog. I mean, equally. You know, Eritrea, which is a team that has had to every 2 years find a new set of players because they all disappear because it is one of the most abusive regimes in the world. Equally, that's an underdog. I don't see, you know, they're very different types of underdogs, but I think they still have the spirit of the underdog, which is they've overcome something that is for 9 times out of 10 would just lead to, you know, utter devastation or not to even to lift off the ground. But for them to get through that, yeah. So for me, Bosnia, although they did produce many top players, not through the Bosnian system. I mean, some of them through the Bosnian system. I mean, you've got to think that Dzeko, for instance, survived the siege of Sarajevo as a young boy. You know, all of these players have got a story of escaping, you know, one of the worst incidents, well, probably the worst incident of war and I mean, obviously genocide. I mean, people argue, I mean, Serbs argue not, but genocide in Europe in the post-Second World War period, you know. To me, that does encapsulate the spirit of the underdog. The only thing that I wish I'd done with the Bosnia chapter is I'd wish, and this is something that I've travelled to Bosnia only recently. I mean, the original chapter was much more about the refugee experience, the experience of people that have fled and run away and started new lives, and how that team for them traveling around Europe was really a lightning rod for them and for their almost old national identity. They'd all become German, they'd become British, they'd become Spanish. But this team traveling around was something very important that united people that had fled the horrors that they'd seen. But something that going back recently to Bosnia, only a month ago or 6 weeks ago, was the issue of Republika Srpska, which is the Bosnian Serb enclave, or not enclave, it's half the country, who don't support the Bosnian team, who have very few Bosnian Serb players. Nevan Subotic, who Borussia Dortmund centre back, comes from Banja Luka, which is the capital of Republika Srpska in Bosnia. He didn't choose to represent Bosnia. He chose to represent the Serbian national team instead. So when you've got this going on and a very dysfunctional state, and yet you can still put together a team that, you know, does have players good enough to play for some of the best teams in the world. Yeah, I think that does. One example where I did choose not to use a team was I was going to use Belgium, simply because, again, size I think is very important, and equally there is between the Flemish and the Walloons within the country, you know, there's a very real possibility that Belgium might not exist in 10 years' time, and there's a division within Belgian society that is kind of being kind of rubbed away in the national team. But previously, it always been a big thing. French speakers and Flemish speakers. You go to a football match and you go to the press conference, and there's two separate press conferences in two different languages, which is crazy when you think of a country the size of Belgium. But it's actually the immigrant population coming in, many descended from people from Democratic Republic of Congo and other African countries who aren't brought up in that same very divisive way, like someone like Vincent Kompany. So it's actually the influx of second, third generation immigrants within the national team that's kind of diffused that and allowed that team to really thrive. And although they probably could have gone further at the World Cup, I mean, if you look at actually the size of the population, you know, it's an incredible achievement that they can produce that amount of talent. I mean, it's an incredible amount of talent. So, yeah, there is a thread that joins them. I guess it's a definition in my head in some respect. But I, you know, I didn't put Belgium in because to me, you know, it failed the test that I think you're putting up. I think that did fail the test. Whereas Bosnia did pass it. I think.
Great. Thank you for that. David Kilpatrick in New York.
Hi, James. Congratulations on pulling off a really daring, unbelievably ambitious project. I have to say.
Thank you.
I think if this was a proposed project by a first-time writer on Kickstarter, I'd happily contribute over the cost of the book and just say good luck with that. But you pulled it off with such beautifully written prose, too. It's really like icing on the cake. My question is about the very notion of these impossible dreams. And you know, you say international football matters. And I guess I'm curious, you know, we can still have 31 nils. We can have the quixotic football fantasies with cup ties, right? We have that with,
yeah.
But what is it in particular that you feel is at stake with international football? The earlier question addressed the notion of transnationalisms and kind of the hodgepodge ways of assembling certain teams. What do you think is the future for international football, and why did you feel the need to address these impossible dreams in international football rather than club football?
Because I mean, this gets really to the nub of it. Because for me, growing up, international football, for many people growing up, I'm 35, so you know, this is in an age, especially for English football fans, before the Premier League became the Premier League. You know, this is a time when football was a pretty dirty, violent, you know, avowedly working class, cheap, and failing sport. And the national team, you know, the league was very much secondary. I mean, there'll be people that say it wasn't, but the absolute apex, the absolute pinnacle for almost everybody was the national football team to get, you know. And national football teams matter because if you take down to a local level, a local club represents its local community. And so it's an important, you know, mirror on that community. And that's why people are passionate for it, because that it represents their community and they're proud about the community. National football teams take that and extrapolate it onto a national level. And I know it's a cliche when Orwell says, you know, football is war minus the shooting. But when you get to a national level, it really is. And, you know, and I mentioned this earlier, national football teams press the same part of the brain that I think that a lot of kind of things that dictators really want to tap into, that kind of passion, the kind of organization, the kind of desire and will and support and almost single-mindedness. So for me, you know, I think that patriotism and, I mean, nationalism is a bit of a loaded term, but in terms of kind of pride for your country, I think it's something that's almost become very unfashionable. And I wanted to show in a small way that it shouldn't be unfashionable, that you should be proud of, you know, of where you're from. That is a very amorphous thing. As you looked at the Kosovo chapter, or the chapter about Albania and Switzerland, where you're from, what your identity is. Myself, I'm half Polish and half English, and I feel that I'm half British, half Polish, and I feel, yeah, I was brought up in Britain, and I can barely speak Polish. My Polish is like a 5-year-old, but I still feel an important identity there, and I still feel an important identity when I watch the Polish national team play. So for me, I wanted to try somehow, and this is slightly tailored to an English audience as well, because, you know, when you don't seem to see these problems, you know, especially in American sport or German sport, the national team, where there is a real kind of love for the national teams. In England, we're losing that, you know, and I wanted to try to, if not reignite a debate, then at least try to reignite the love that you can have for a national team and the pride you could have there. So I don't think it's something that we should be ashamed of, and it's something that I think a lot of people have become ashamed of. And what was your other question? Sorry, just remind me.
No, that was it, really. You know, I kind of share that sense of national sporting. My national team is a bit of a guilty pleasure, and
yeah.
as someone who thinks of himself as cosmopolitan rather than an American, I kind of favor club over country. But your book made me see it in a very, very different way. Very different.
I mean, that's the thing, and also, I mean, I consider myself. I mean, I was just having a few tweets with Gabriel Marcotti, who we often argue, you know, about stuff like this, and you know, I think we kind of agree on the idea that national teams are. I mean, he doesn't have a problem because he's Italian, so all the Italians, you know, there's a feverish love for the national team, but the English, I think, have lost something, you know, and writing this was my attempt to try to re-engage, you know, an audience with that, but telling stories that also had a global interest, I think, you know. And there's a recent very good example of the mindset within the British journalist establishment, and that was, you know, we've got the European qualifiers coming up at the moment, and England were playing San Marino, and, you know, people were like, why are we playing these teams? It's ridiculous. And it's like, it's not just about the best team playing the best team. If that was all sport was about, then all we would have is a super league of the best 5 teams and everybody else could go to hell. But look, people go to games at every level. You go to any park in the US, you go to any park in Germany or the UK, you've got people in their dozens, you know, maybe 2 or 3 people watching a game because that game and that club means something to them. It says something to them, you know. And national football is a larger extrapolation of that. You know, national football isn't about the best. It's about representing your country and being proud to represent it and being proud to support it. And, you know, for me, that's something that I wish that we could see that, especially the Premier League. You know, money trumps everything. And actually, I think that, and it's something that the left, I think, and I consider myself a liberal, I don't know if I'm on the left, but I mean, I consider myself liberal. It's almost a dirty word to talk about patriotism. And I think we've allowed, you know, those on the right and the far right to wrap themselves in the flag, and we should be proud of that. And I think that's another kind of undercurrent to this, is that I think we should be proud of who we are, whatever that is, and not be afraid to express that. And national football teams or national soccer teams, I think, is a very, very, I guess, safe or kind of entry-level way in doing that and introducing people back into that concept without feeling that it's some kind of dirty concept.
A very different note for the second question. The title, and again, these impossible dreams, and you talk so much about, you know, the dream, but then when the reality kicks in. Here in the United States, competitive parity, is an obsession. Major League Soccer is built around the very idea of parity.
Yeah.
And at the grassroots level, a game that doesn't end in a draw is invariably upsetting many parents who want there to be blowout rules or mercy rules, whatever you call it. Do you find a certain virtue in being blown out? Should games be stopped? Or is there are there lessons that you think kids need to learn from a 31-0 scoreline?
Now, I think kids are a different kettle of fish. I think when children are playing competitive sport, you know, and we have this argument in England all the time, you shouldn't have, you know, 10-year-olds on a full-size 11-side pitch where really those defeats do have long-lasting psychological... And God knows, I know, I was a goalkeeper continuously from the age of 10, pretty much until the CNN team, which I played for when I was 27, 28, which lost heavily in double figures. And I guess deep down, I mean, you could say it was damaged, but I ended up writing the book. And I suppose that's where the love of the underdog has always happened. And competitive balance is important, but you've got to have competitive balance, I think, at every level. So you can have, for me, I think competitive balance is absolutely essential. You've got to have a Premier League that, like the MLS, where you don't know who's going to win it every week. But it's the level below where you have relegation and promotion. On that level, they should have competitive balance. And it should be competitive balance at every single level going down. You should never have a blowout rule. But there is almost, and this is something that I think speaks to the spirit of football, which is something that we talk about. I'm not sure if this translates in the States at all, but a spirit of the game, you know, a kind of, you know, a higher understanding of sportsmanship within football. And we talk about the spirit of cricket as well, very much the same way. That when it gets to, you know, 10-0, 12-0, then you kind of stop, you know, and it's kind of an unwritten rule.
It was good.
And the difference happened with 31-0, and having spent time in Australia with Australians, and having, as an Englishman who loves cricket, you know, endured many a crushing defeat by the Australians in the Ashes, which is the big rivalry we have in Test cricket. You know, the Australians, they don't stop. they go for the kill, and they will kill until you're dead. And I can't imagine a single nationality or national team that might have scored 31 goals other than the Australians. In fact, there's a funny anecdote about this, because long before I had this idea for the book, I met Dick Advocaat, who, the famous Dutch coach. He was coaching in the UAE, and I was having dinner. Bizarrely, I don't want to sound like I'm some kind of, I'm not trying to big myself up here, but I was working for Time Out as a journalist, and we managed to organise, what's his name? Gordon Ramsay, who had a restaurant there, and Dick Advocaat, who, Ramsay's a Rangers supporter, Dick Advocaat's a former Glasgow Rangers coach, and we got them having dinner together, and I asked him about, you know, I was sort of kind of interviewing them both, and I asked him about kind of what happened after 31-0, because he had a couple of Australian players playing there, and he actually got, for the first time, angry, and he said he was so angry with the players that they would humiliate, you know, a team in that way, that he dropped them both for their next game. So there's you don't need a mercy rule, because there's kind of automatically a kind of a moral code of the mercy rule. But, you know, those defeats become less and less. I think you've got to say that having the smaller teams mixed in with the big teams makes those teams better. It's the only way that they'll improve. Plus, clever, you know, exploitation of the diaspora as well, which explains why San Marino doesn't do too well. But look at the European Championship qualifiers that we've got on at the moment. And people, you know, every journalist thinks it's going to be a disaster, it's going to be a cakewalk. You know, why are we playing these teams? And look what happens. You know, Poland beat Germany. We've had Portugal, you know, losing. We've had, I mean, it's just been you know, underdog triumph after underdog triumph after underdog triumph. And actually what it's done is by giving more qualification spaces for the European and expanding the competition, what you've had is you've given those teams greater incentive and you know, they're rising to the challenge. Now, San Marino might never rise to the challenge, but, you know, there is a certain egalitarian fraternity to international football. And, you know, you have everybody, and that includes San Marino, and you know what? Everybody else go hang. I want them there. You know, I like the fact that those players want to represent their country. Who cares if they're not good? Who cares about that? It's not about that. They want to represent their country. They want to represent their state. They want to represent their national team. And, you know, that is the only thing that matters.
Thank you. Andrew Guest in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, thanks. Like everyone else, really enjoy the book and really enjoy your work. I always find myself seeing these interesting headlines on the New York Times or other places on the internet and thinking, I wonder who wrote this, and it almost always ends up being James. I actually am sort of curious how you got that niche, but I think I'll put that question aside temporarily for a more kind of academic question. One of the things that I always have fun talking with students about in terms of issues around sports and globalization is the kind of broad and general question of whether cultural forms, globalized forms like soccer, are forces for homogenization or for heterogeneity. And it's kind of a classic, a little bit artificial academic question, but, you know, and sometimes phrased as like the McDonaldization of society. And it strikes me that you are potentially better positioned than anybody else I've ever spoken with to address that question, and given all the range of places that you've observed, whether, you know, if I kind of forced you to take a side in that, whether you see soccer as something that's more promoting homogenization as a force of globalization, or whether there's room for heterogeneity, whether places are kind of taking on in different forms. And if I could, I would tag on, I know that's a big question, but if I could tag on another thing that struck me in the book in particular is, you know, you don't obviously often think of America as much of a force in global soccer, but there is a lot of American influence that runs through the book, whether it's, you know, the obvious ones like Bob Bradley coaching Egypt the American Samoa example that we've discussed, but also things like, you know, some of the players from the Palestinian team being essentially
Omar Giroud,
the Haitians, or the even the Bosnians, you know, with a big American influence. So
Vucevic from St. Louis. I mean, look, I mean, to me, you know, this is an article that I've actually tried to get off the ground a couple of times, and I found actually surprisingly little interest in it. But for me, cast your mind back a few years ago when, I don't know if you remember this debate, one of the reasons that the FIFA changed its naturalization laws was, I mean, Qatar were kind of abusing the system, but it was also the fact that there were Brazilians were ending up everywhere. The number of Brazilian players that were getting exported from Brazil was huge. And I think there was one example that was always used was that the Vietnamese national team goalkeeper was Brazilian. You know, Brazilians were turning up everywhere. And what they're worried about was that you then just suddenly have national teams, you know, 50% full of Brazilians, because they're just producing so many technically good players that would walk into virtually every national team, every national team on the planet. So they changed the rules and that stopped. But what was fascinating is that what America has, because it's an immigrant nation, and it has, you know, obviously almost every country under the sun has an immigrant community there, you know, they are exporting huge amounts of players and filling national teams across the world in a way that is almost impossible to stop. You can't stop it. But it's very different, because obviously with the Brazilian example, you are just essentially taking a Brazilian player, dropping him into a local league, and then they end up playing for that team, and they might not speak the language. It's much more complicated, because obviously if you grew up in an immigrant community anywhere, there is still some tropes there, food, maybe prayer, music, culture, those kind of things. And so one of the things from this book that I picked up was that America, over the next 10, 15 years, is going to be exporting even larger amounts of these players that will end up playing, and they might speak with American accents, but they will have the essential component which can't be legislated against, which is either their parents will be from the original country of origin or their grandparents will be. And so America, you know, we're seeing a huge growth in the MLS. We're seeing a huge growth in the success of the national team, or at least interest in the national team. But for me, the real big growth area will be the number of very highly educated, highly extremely fit, very well coached American soccer players who have maybe grown up, born and bred in their American cities, who are going to end up playing for national teams all around the world. And it won't be seen as, a poverty of the original country's resources that they have to call upon those American players in the first place.
And that's true.
I just thought
the McWorld part of the question.
The McWorld part of the question. I mean, in a way, I think it is a homogenization. I mean, it is probably. I've said this in my previous book as well. Is that the original 1863? FA rule book. That was made, and the game looks very different today, and the rules are very different today, but. The book of association football rules, is the greatest act of cultural homogenization the world, I think, has ever seen. I think, really, if you think about how important football is in countries as diverse as Argentina and Japan, or, literally every, you can even look at, there are always places that kind of buck the trend. So 10 years ago, you could say, well, the Americans, it's not growing there. Look at Pakistan, look at India, look at China. Okay, look what's happening in India now. Look what's happening in America now. Look what's happening in China now. There are very few dark spots for soccer. And this, has been, and that is a cultural homogenization. It's a Western homogenization. But what is the beauty for me of football is that it's very much a framework. It's just a pitch. Look at a pitch. Look at the markings. That's what the cultural homogenization is. It's the goals. It's the rules. It's the number of players that you have. And outside of that, you can do whatever you like, and it can look whatever it wants to do. It can be sung in whatever language on the terraces. The rivalries and the derbies can take on any number of political meanings. And I think that is. Like any good virus, it's not about your ability to latch onto people. It's your ability to adapt, and that's what the beauty of soccer is. It is one of the greatest acts of homogenization that the human race has ever managed to achieve. I truly believe that, but it's also around it the ability for us to adapt it to our own. Local cultural and political forces that has allowed it to endure, I think.
Great, thank you. We've had a couple of instant messages here. I seem to have lost the queue. Who is next? With apologies if I've overlooked somebody. Anybody?
There's a point that... David was making about the 1990 team. I could hear my voice.
Okay.
I was actually making a point about the 1930 U.S. team, and that I think you're quite right. But one thing about American identity is that it's always hyphenated, right?
Yeah.
You're Scottish American, even if your ancestors have been, came over here 200 years ago.
Yeah.
And yet still there is a need for our national team to import players too. But we forget about the 1930 team all too easily. We suffer from amnesia in America.
It's we're so used to America being a power that we forget that America's a very new country, and that you know, it's still struggling in many respects with its identity and you know, with who it is. And again, looking at the history of national teams in American soccer, I think it reflects that perfectly. Sorry, my phone just went off.
Okay, Alex has a question, and I believe Stephen is typing, may have another one as well. We have about 15 minutes left in the match.
I have a question, but also a brief comment here. We're interacting for those of you following on Twitter. James, you mentioned Next Goal Wins, and we tweeted about it, and I tagged their Twitter account, and now we're discussing how to watch it. So I'm not sure what will come of it, but serendipity on the internet is
really good. Well, this is it. This is what it is. No time, no space.
No time, no space. Exactly. my question was, a curiosity. What would you have to add on your chapter with the Albania Serbia match where they had to abandon the match because of the drone showing the flag?
I mean,
unified territory.
I would. For one, I'd make sure I was there. it is a source of great annoyance that I wasn't, because it's a story obviously that I've been following for a long time. But it's also just before I went to Australia. I think it's very clear that this was something like this was going to happen. I think it's very clear from my travels around the Balkans, and you know, I spent a lot of time in Croatia, spent a lot of time in Serbia and Kosovo, and just spent a lot of time in Bosnia. And especially we're talking about the divide, Republika Srpska and the Bosnia and Herzegovina divide within the Bosnian state, that, you know, all of these problems have not been dealt with adequately. You know, these divisions still exist. In many places, the war's still going on. They're not fighting. You know, the communities are as divided as ever. And one of the things I think that this, you know, this tapped into was, on the one hand, you know, I think, you know, spending time in Republika Srpska, you can see it. The Serbs feel that they have been victimized by the international community, and that, you know, when you see something like this happen, the Kosovars see that they are victimized by the international community because they haven't been recognized. And there's, you know, my conclusions, I think, would be exactly the same. I just think that the color from that would have obviously been, would have been great to get in, but you know, the war's still going on there, you know, and nobody seems to be understanding or dealing with what is about to come. And I think that could be a very serious repetition of the past. And this is something, going to Bosnia especially, and Bosnia, remember, you know, Bosnia isn't, it is a country, obviously, and it's a nation, it's a very old nation. But, you know, Bosnia today is a microcosm of a very dysfunctional Yugoslav Republic, you know. So if you want to understand how people are getting on, you know, between those communities, look at Bosnia and you can see that it doesn't work. And none of these issues are being dealt with. None of the issues about memory, memorializing past atrocities. Everything is so couched in ethnic and religious issues. And I look towards Lebanon. You know, I mean, Daniel was someone who lives there now, but having spent time there, I see the similarities between Bosnia and Lebanon. And the reason why Lebanon's interesting is, although at the moment it's relatively peaceful, though the Syrian war is kind of destabilizing the country. But you said you have a state that is divided by ethnic lines. You have religious lines. You have a state that doesn't, that tries to forget the horrors of the past. And then if it forgets them, then it is cursed to always repeat it. And that's what happens in Lebanon. Every few years, the same problems come to the fore. And I fear that Bosnia, which is, I think, the bellwether for all of these issues within the Balkans, I think that's what's going to happen. And, you know, it's a real shame because, you know, we're especially in America and especially in the UK, you are kind of taught, or maybe it's just the kind of the media coverage that we were fed, you know, that the Serbians are the bad guys and that's it. And it's much more complicated than that. You know, it doesn't denigrate what happened at Srebrenica or any of the other terrible massacres, but, you know, the Serbs have to be heard. And I think what happened and the punishment that the Serbs got, which is ridiculous, because for me, flying a Kosovo, flying a Albanian flag, talking about greater Albania onto the pitch, and then having the players attack a Serbian player, an Albanian player, attacking a Serbian player for taking it down. Actually, you know, that they shouldn't be punished for that, but they were, and it's only just going to increase their feeling of victimhood, and it's going to increase their feeling that they are being alienated and victimized by the international community. And what happens? A week later, Vladimir Putin rolls into town and he's a hero. So he said he'll never recognize Kosovo. And that's the real danger in the world.
If I mean,
you are giving me an opportunity to literally just talk. So I could be talking absolute crap. I mean, I really apologize about that.
Well, I mean, you raise all sorts of issues with that particular response, in terms of at least Serb perceptions of victimization. I think we're sort of coming close to the end of our conversation. Maybe it's too late to open up this can of worms. I mean, it's a fascinating discussion to have. If I understood you correctly, I'm not sure I agree, but maybe...
It's not about whether... Whether we believe that what happened happened as it did, it's the perception they have, and that has to be dealt with. Why do they have that perception? And until you deal with that perception, then nothing will ever change. You know, there's only you know, we can talk about numbers and we can talk about things that happened during that war, but if you have a country of people who believe that, you know, no matter which way they look, they're being victimized, then there's no peace to be made there. So you have to start to address those concerns. So it is about building the peace, and it's about working out how to do that. And at the moment, we've got it wrong. As in the international community.
Well, I mean, another argument, of course, that has been made is that by dealing with the reality and getting at the partial truth, if not the whole truth, of what went down in recent years, you're simply going to enhance those narratives of victimization and those perceptions of being wronged. But let's leave that for another session, because that's quite a complicated discussion, and we only have a few minutes left. I don't see other questions in the queue, but I have a question about language.
Yeah.
Whenever you deal with global studies on a planet with thousands of languages, it seems to me interesting the importance of language in this study. How important is it to you in your travels? And particularly, how do you use language to both understand local knowledge and soccer dynamics, but also, you know, how does it affect your ability to convey the insights that you draw during your visits to the reading public? And I know you mentioned various local intermediaries that assist you in the process.
Yeah.
But I'm specifically interested in languages, which languages you speak, and how you deal with issues of interpretation, and what you may be missing as an outsider, as well as what you may be gaining from your position as an outsider.
So I gain and lose in equal measure. I mean, when you've got a book with this kind of scope on this many kind of continents, of course, it's impossible to speak. I'd have had to have spoken 25, 26 different languages. Equally, if I'd gone to these matches and I'd not spoken at all, and I just observed, then we wouldn't have been that far from what had happened. You know, I mean, obviously I interact with a lot of people, and they're very interesting moments in the book as well. But I don't think it would have been that much different. I mean, it would have been better if I'd gone, I go to Serbia, for instance, I speak a little bit of Polish, and I kind of, you get around those countries with a little bit of, you know, it's a Slavic language, so you kind of get past. But actually what was important wasn't necessarily what languages I spoke, it was languages they spoke. Because football, you know, the lingua franca is English. So once you got to the grounds, once you got to the players, once you got to the fans, once you got to the people who organized it, you found that there was actually, and I found this when I wrote the first book about football in the Middle East, which is far more, out there in terms of language barriers, really, or you'd think so. And actually, I didn't ever have any money for interpreters because I was pretty much on a shoestring budget. So a couple of times it'd be local journalists would help out, but most of the time, you know, it was pretty good through English. It kind of worked. And again, I think this is something that could only really happen in football. Or, I mean, I imagine if you did a book about touring the world about hip hop, something that is kind of in its roots, kind of based in an Anglophone in an Anglophile tradition, then you would then find people who obviously listened a lot to rap music that was rapped in English, and that was it. You know, you would find people, there would be a constituency there that would automatically have some kind of affinity and understanding of English. And I found that within football, and I found that that's actually been something that has saved my bacon over the past 10 years. I mean, if I was a foreign correspondent doing all facets of life, I think it would be almost impossible. I think it would be almost impossible to do it. But, you know, English has been, you know, the main language I've done it through. I mean, but then, you know, a little bit goes a long way. You know, a couple of words of, I lived in Spain for a little bit, so I have a few bits of Spanish. Lived in the Middle East, a couple of bits of Arabic, but nothing to be able to, yeah, really get to the roots of that culture. And there are no doubts parts of it that I missed because of it. But because I fully believe that as an outsider, again, maybe making drawing comparisons and writing a book about cider and seeing myself as an outsider, as an outsider looking in and observing something almost as an alien, and that's kind of how I've looked at it, you know, sometimes I've been kind of glad that that's how it's been, you know, because I've seen it in a way in its purest sense. Because once you get down the road of like, okay, so you cover this country, they speak Spanish, and unless you speak fluent Spanish, you don't understand anything that goes on there. I don't believe that's true. I think you can observe the human condition without the need for that. And I think it takes out, I think it takes the poison out of the debate, I think, a little bit. But then sorry.
No, it's a question that academics in particular worry about a lot. And to be fair, journalists and others as well. But for academics, particularly those of us who work outside of the global north, you know, language is a very powerful thing. And what is said and what is said is not always the most important thing. What is not said sometimes is even more important. And sort of the indirect conversations that are going on around you also shape the kind of knowledge that one ends up producing, you know, for the northern audiences.
And this is what, I mean, I don't see myself as north or south or east or west. I mean, you know, I mean, I guess I'm a product of Britain and I guess I have Polish blood, but I mean, I've traveled enough in the world where, you know, I don't really see myself as anyone or anything. But I mean, I spoke to a University of Bristol where John Foot and Simon Cooper and a couple of people about cultural translation. Exactly these things came up about language and how we should. Sorry, I'm getting a bit of reverb here.
By the way, we had a nice round table with John and Simon and Grant Wall at the Hofstra conference in April.
So I know they were all there. I was following it on Twitter, so it sounded great. But before then, we had a thing about cultural translation, and this very issue came up, you know. And what I try to do is, it's for me, it's not necessarily about interviews and talking to people. It's the sounds and noises of the things around you. It's the leaflets that you pick up and what they're saying. It's recording. And bearing in mind that everything that I did was recorded on radio equipment, because I did a lot. So the only one of the ways I paid for my trip was by or paid for the book, really, was that I was reporting for the BBC and the New York Times, and the book was kind of a byproduct of that. So there was a microphone that had everything, so I could come back to it later, and I'd have an inkling that a chant or something was being said, or I could ask somebody because of this leaflet was being given out by the police at a protest in Belo Horizonte. You know, these were things that you could piece it together. You know, so I didn't speak. I'm not a what's it? Is it polyglot? Is that the word to use? Somebody who speaks lots of languages.
Sounds about right.
I'm not a polyglot. I can barely speak English that well. But you piece it together, and I don't think I could have done this book in any other cultural realm other than football. Seriously, you know, and so if it was anything, well, maybe hip hop, but I don't think I'm knowledgeable enough on that. But I think football was the thing that I could have done it in. Soccer.
Well, that's a great note to bring our conversation to a close. The universal language of football that brings us together on a regular basis out here where there is no time and no space. And we juggle virtual footballs and play with these ideas and listen to the kinds of insights and work that is out there that really is just so invigorating. So we thank you, James, for taking the time to chat with us in your travels, and we hope that you'll come back and participate in other convos of the FSF. You've got our website, footballscholars.org, and it's just been a real pleasure, and thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'll definitely come back and argue with you. Maybe about the Balkans. I think that might be the next one that we should talk about. That sounds like that's got some legs in it. But thank you so much for reading it. It's been wonderful talking to you all about it. It's great. You know, every opportunity I have to relive it is, and I'll relive it for the rest of my life, because it was the most fantastic thing that's ever happened to me. And I'm just glad that it's touched you in some way. Thank you.
Okay, we'll be in touch. Bye, everyone.